You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Delighted you're here. I'm Ken Lieberthal. I'm director of the John L. Thornton China Center at Brookings. Our program this morning focuses on a very important set of developments. The People's Republic of China in March of this year adopted the 12th five-year plan. That five-year plan, to a startling extent, really lays out a new development model for China, effectively changing a lot of the parameters of development from what we've seen in the highly successful Chinese economy in recent decades. The program today is designed to lay out some of the key elements in that new model and to discuss them. We have, I think, two of the best speakers possible for those dual tasks. Mr. Cheng Siwei is a prominent Chinese economist. He's former vice chairman of the Standing Committee of the National People's Congress. He currently serves as chairman of China's International Finance Forum, among other positions, I might add. His collected works have been published in Chinese and will be published later this year in English under the title Economic Reforms and Development in China. Chairman Cheng is the recipient of the Asia Foundation's Chang Lin Tian Distinguished Visiting Fellow Award. This fellowship honors the late Dr. Chang Lin Tian, who is former chancellor of the University of California, Berkeley, marking his elevation in 1999 to chairman of the Board of Trustees of the Asia Foundation. The Chang Lin Tian Distinguished Fellowship Program was established to foster leadership exchanges for distinguished and emerging leaders to meet and interact with their counterparts in Asia and the U.S. And as a recipient of that award, Cheng Siwei has been touring the United States with stops, I know, in California, New York, Boston, Florida, and here, speaking in each place on various aspects of China's economic development and the future of the Chinese economy. We're delighted to have him here today. Let me note also finally that in his long and distinguished career, he has also served as Vice Minister of the Chemical Industry in China from 1994 to 1997. Cheng Siwei will give remarks of roughly 30 minutes to lay out some of the key parameters of China's five-year plan, with special reference to the green economy. He has done an enormous amount of work, especially on clean energy issues in China. And then I'm delighted also to welcome Professor Barry Naughton, who is an economist and professor at the University of California at San Diego. As anyone who has studied the Chinese economy knows, Professor Naughton is one of the leading macroeconomists focused on China in the United States. He is focused generally on four interrelated areas, on economic transition, industry and technology, foreign trade, and China's political economy. His book on growing out of the plan won the Masayoshi Ohira Memorial Prize. His more recent book, The Chinese Economy, Transition and Growth, has become a standard text in courses on China in the United States. And finally, I want to note that Professor Naughton was named the, I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly, Suk Wen Luk Professor at the Graduate School of International Relations and Pacific Studies of the University of California, San Diego. He has held that chair for now more than a decade. So we will lead first with Cheng Siwei, then Professor Naughton will come up. At the end of Professor Naughton's presentation, our two speakers will sit in the two chairs here, and I will moderate Q&A from the audience. So let me get out of the way and let the speakers begin. Chairman Cheng, please.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm very glad to be here and to share my thoughts with you. But first of all, I have to make an announcement since I'm officially retired from the National People's Congress. So I'm no longer speak on behalf of the Chinese Parliament. So what I'm saying here is based on my research and my thoughts as a scholar. Today I was requested to speak on the 12th five-year plan, but because the time limit, I only can pick a few focus. I want to talk four highlights. As you know, since 2003, China enjoyed a two-digit growth from 2003 to 2007. In 2007, we got a 13% growth rate. And then from 2008, we met the under the influence of a global financial crisis. So our growth rate dropped quite a bit, quite a large part. And so in the fourth quarter of 2008, we launched a 4 trillion RMB stimulus package. According to my research, without this package, our growth rate only maybe 2.4%. But with this stimulus package, we got a 9.2% growth rate. But in the year 2010, starting from the year 2010, the negative effects were emerged. So, for example, the investment overheat caused the excess capacity, the over inventory, the lower investment return, and the more environmental problems. And also the excess of liquidity caused the bubble of the financial assets, especially the real estate assets, and also the increase of local government debts, and also the danger of inflation. So we did a research on this, the lessons from the global financial crisis for China. And actually, we found out the former development pattern relying heavily on investment and foreign demand is not sustainable. So in the 12th five-year plan, the first thing is we need to change our development pattern from relying on investment and net export to relying more on domestic consumption. But this is not an easy job, because if we want to rely more on domestic consumption, first, we have to raise people's purchasing power. So I propose the three institutional arrangements. One is to synchronize people's income with economic growth. I think we almost reached this target. In last year, the people's income after the adjust of the inflation were 9.8 and 8.5 in rural area and urban area respectively. And second is to link the salary with inflation rate. And at this time being, 30 provinces in China all linked the minimum salary with inflation rate. And the third is we need to increase workers' reward along with the increase of productivity. And we are still doing this. And besides, we have two additional measures. One is to raise the floor of personal income tax from 800 RMB to 1600 RMB to 2000 RMB, and recently we raised to 3500 RMB. So at this time being, only 9% of Chinese people should pay personal income tax. So I just tease my American friends, if I were the presidential candidate in the United States, I will add one more 9 to the 3 9s. Only 9% of us people needs to pay the income tax. And on the other hand, we need to promote credit consumption, because at this time being, our bank loans, only 15% of our bank loans is the personal credit. So we will, and in developed countries, it's 60 to 70. So what we need is to promote the credit consumption. And we encourage Chinese people to save less and spend more to improve the global imbalance. And the second is, that, so this is first, we need to raise people's income that people can consume. And the second is we need to improve our social security system, let people have less hesitation in spending their money. So that means let people dare to consume. And last but not least is we need to develop more innovative new products, let people will to consume. So I said we need more Steve Jobs in China so we can have more innovative products like the Apple, you know, iPod, iPod Nano, iPod Touch, iPhone 2S, iPhone 3S, iPhone 4, iPhone 4S, iPad 1, iPad 2. Right? So this is the first, that people can consume, dare to consume, and will to consume. So only by this we can, you know, rely more on domestic consumption. And the second is we should pay more attention to the sustainable development. According to our research, in the year 2005, our environmental cost, including the low energy efficiency, the environmental pollution, and the damage of ecosystem, consists that 13.5% of our GDP. But that year, our GDP only increased by 10.4%. So it means we leave our environmental debts to our children and grandchildren. So this cannot be sustainable. So in this case, we have to pay more attention to the environmental issue, to sustainable development on the, this domestically. Internationally, because the global warming is a hot issue all over the world. So China also needs to take our responsibility to reduce the CO2 emission per GDP. So in this case, we have to develop our green economy. In my opinion, the green economy includes the low carbon economy, recycling economy, and the eco economy. And low carbon economy at this time being is a very hot topic. And there are, in my opinion, there are four measures in the low carbon economy. One is to develop the green industries which do not emit CO2 or emit very little amount of CO2. And the second is to revamping the existing enterprises to reduce the CO2 emission. Third is to utilize CO2 as raw materials. At this time being, only some Coca-Cola and some beverage use CO2. But in the future, I think chemical industry should play a more important role in utilizing CO2 as the raw materials. For example, the polycarbonate, I was the vice minister of chemical industry, so I know this. You know, the polycarbonate used in the CDs, DVDs, they use phosphine as, in the past, they used phosphine as the raw material. This is toxic. And if we can use dimethyl carbonate as the raw material, it will utilizing more CO2, and so this is very good. And last is we need to promote the CO2 capture and storage, CCS. But certainly at this time, it cannot be cost justified. According to our research in China now, to capture and storage one ton CO2 at least needs 160 yuan RMB. So at this time, it's not cost justified. So in China's case, I will remind you, I would like to remind you, firstly, China is a developing country. So we are still developing. So in this case, we cannot promise to reduce the CO2 total amount, but what we need is to promise to reduce the CO2 per GDP. Our government already announced by the year 2020, we will reduce our CO2 emission by 40 to 45% on 2005 basis. And in the 12th five-year plan, we will reduce our CO2 for 17% per GDP. So at this time, and also on the other hand, China is a country relying heavily on fossil energy. At this time being, our energy consumption, 90% of energy consumption is fossil energy, 70% coal and 20% petroleum and natural gas. So in this case, even we put a lot of effort to develop new energy, but still by the year 2020, we only can reduce the fossil energy percentage in our energy consumption from 90% to 85%. So at this time being, in the short period, our target is low energy consumption, low pollution, and low emission, three lows. This is very important because we have to put reducing the CO2 emission in our existing industries as the first priority. So, for example, our coal-fired power plant at this time being average coal consumption is 350 gram standard coal. And the most advanced plant only consume 284 grams. So if we can reduce the coal consumption, average coal consumption to 300 grams, it will be a big save of coal and also will reduce CO2 emission. Second is we need to develop new energy, green economy, green industries, mainly including new energy, modern service industries, culture industries, etc. And we launched a very ambitious new energy development plan. By the year 2020, the total investment will be 5 trillion RMB. And by the year 2020, our hydropower will increase from 200 million kilowatts installation capacity to 300 million. Our nuclear will increase from a little more than 10 million to 60 to 70 million. But now we are reconsidering this plan, and we would like, in my opinion, we still need to develop nuclear energy. But we need to put safety at the first priority. And our wind power will increase from a little more than 20 million kilowatts to 120 million by the year 2020. The solar energy will increase from 6 million to 30 million. So you can see this is a very ambitious new energy development plan. And certainly it needs to be approved by the National People's Congress in next year. And also the new service, the modern service industry is also very important, including the modern financial service industry, information industry, logistics industry, exhibition industry, consulting industry, and management industry. They are all the industries which do not emit CO2. And the third is the culture industry. Along with the income increase of Chinese people, the demand of cultural products and cultural service is growing. So in China, at this time being, cultural industry only 3% of our GDP. And in the developed countries, it's over 10%. So there is a big room to develop cultural industry. And on the other hand, through develop other culture and export culture industry, we have promoted a better mutual understanding between Chinese people and the foreign people. For example, I'm a Tai Chi practitioner, but I found out Tai Chi is not so popular, well-known, comparing with Yuga, India Yuga. So I would like to encourage you to practice Tai Chi. I'm 76 years old. I can still stand there and speak. Okay. So I think this green industries also is very important. We need to develop them. And recently, the CPC Central Committee, the sixth Central Committee, passed the resolution to develop our culture, the Chinese culture. The culture industry is also an important part in the resolution. And the third is we need to improve our opening policy. In the past, especially after we joined the World WTO, World Trade Organization, our foreign trade increased quite fast. But because the financial crisis, the developed countries are deleveraging. So China is, the result is we need to decapacity. So in this case, we need to rethinking of our opening policy and improve the policy. I think mostly first is we would like to make our trade more balanced. People are talking about the trade imbalance between China and the United States. How can we solve this problem? I think we need to solve this problem by the effort from both sides, because at this time being China export to the United States is in the lower end, and the United States export to China is on the higher end. So in the lower end, we cannot buy your products because our products are much more cheap than yours. Then in the higher end, you should release some limitations to make the trade more balanced. I teased my American friend. I said, if you can sell a space shuttle to us, it will improve the trade imbalance, but you won't, right? So in this case, we need to balance the trade by export more from the United States to China. And the second is we don't need to politicize the trade imbalance issue. Several years ago, when I was in the United States, my friend told me there is a American congressman said, you see, all ships come from China are fully loaded. All ships go to China are empty. So how serious the trade imbalance is, I said, nothing surprising, because what we sell to you is shoes, toys, glasses. They have to be shipped by vessels. But what you sell to us is chips and high-tech products. They are shipped by air cargo. So don't politicize this issue, right? And the third is we need to solve this problem through consultation instead of confrontation. There will be no winner in a trade war. But from the Chinese side, we have no intention to pursue a very high surplus, trade surplus. We would like to make our trade more balanced. So in this case, I think we can control our surplus less than 4% of our GDP as requested. And also, we should not accumulate a very high foreign exchange reserve. As you know, the China's foreign exchange reserve is over $3 trillion now. It's really a heavy burden to us because on the one hand, it will limit the independence of our monetary policy, because when one U.S. dollar comes in, we have to pay 6.5 RMB, right? So it will limit the independence of our monetary policy. On the other hand, we will bear the risk of devaluation of the U.S. dollars. According to our research, 20% of our GDP reserve is enough, both including strategic and tactic foreign reserve. So in this case, only $1.2 trillion foreign reserve should be enough for China. But now we are much higher than this number. And around $1.4 trillion is invested in the American governmental bond, treasury bond. And the third is we are going to move to internationalize our currency. We already liberated our capital, our current account by the year 1996. And according to IMF, there are 43 sub-accounts in capital accounts. At this time being, around 20 sub-accounts already liberated. So we still have around 20 sub-accounts to go. And this year, as you know, we took a few steps. One is we announced allow the foreign company to be listed in our Asia market. And also we are testing our offshore renminbi business in Hong Kong. So this means we are moving toward the direction make RMB fully convertible. But certainly we have to be very careful, because first is we have to choose a good timing. Second is we have to improve our capability to control the situation. And the third is we should not announce a timetable, because if we announce a timetable, it will encourage speculation, right? So there are some differences in China on this issue. In my opinion, the sooner the better. But I think, generally speaking, I think the pace of internationalization of renminbi will be accelerated. So, and also, we are encouraging the FDI from China, encouraging our companies to go out. Until now, the FDI to China is $1.15 trillion. And the FDI from China is a little over $300 billion. So I think that we still need to encourage the FDI from China. But the problem is we need to, in the U.S., you need to reduce the limitations. I think some people may be too nervous. I don't think a wash machine has some relationship with national security. I really cannot think about that. Do you know the case of the washing machine case? Okay. And so last but not least is we need to improve our education system. In my opinion, the goal of education system, one is to foster, to raise the level of culture, science, technology, moral of our people. And second is to foster innovative spirit of, to foster innovative talent. So in this case, we need to reform China's education system to pay more attention to foster innovation, innovative spirit. So as I said, we need more Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, but I'm not encouraging the students to give up their efforts to get a bachelor degree. I'm not saying this. And so I think today the competition between countries, mainly the competition between human resources, and behind that is the competition of creativity. So in this case, I think the economy only can guarantee us our today. Science and technology can guarantee our tomorrow, but only education can guarantee our day after tomorrow. So I said, invest in education, invest in our future. So I think this is very important to reform Chinese education system. Certainly, I heard the tiger mother story in the United States. That means, on the other hand, in the United States, maybe you need to pay more attention for the basic training of the students. But in China, I think we need to shift to foster more straight A students to some students with innovative spirits. So I think I give you the four highlights. One is the changing our economic development pattern from relying on investment and the net export to domestic consumption. Second is develop green economy. Third is to improve our opening policy. Fourth is to reform our educational system. Certainly in our 5-year plan, there are many other topics, but because of the time limit, I only can speak these two highlights. Thank you very much for your attention.
That's a tough act to follow. Chuang Tzu-wei has laid out a vision for the transformation of the Chinese economy that I think encapsulates a whole set of goals that I think are goals that many of us share. These are visionary goals about the Chinese economy. So I can't really add anything to the goals. The goals are the fundamental adaptations that a system like China needs as it moves from being a low-income developing country to being a middle and even upper middle-income developing country. I want to raise a set of questions, though, and the set of questions are, how do we get there? Every one of the goals that Chuang Tzu-wei mentioned represents an end state in which the kind of economic activity and the incentive system that drives people are different from the economy that we have today. It's a huge advantage to China that they have individuals and, for that matter, government institutions that whose job is to think about the way the economy develops, the challenges that emerge, and the new types of situations that emerge. China, I often think, we can understand it best in terms of thinking of it as going through a turning point from a labor surplus, low-income economy to a middle-income economy where labor is no longer cheap and surplus, but increasingly skilled, more expensive, and generates more complex and more diverse demands on the economy as well. In other words, China is going through a turning point from a low-skilled economy to a diverse, medium-skilled, middle-income economy. And it's a huge impact on the world. It's a huge impact on the lives of all of us. Now, Chinese thinkers, Chinese economists, Chinese planners started really to envision what this change would mean a little more than 5 years ago. When the 11th five-year plan was produced in 2005, it laid out most of the fundamental themes that have been on the table ever since. And frankly, most of the themes that are expressed today in Chuang Tzu-wei's talk. the need to move away from external demand, the move away from an unbalanced economy, the need to move away towards a more environmental friendly, resource light economy. All those things have been discussed and brought to the fore of Chinese economic policymaking for about 7 years now. So when we look at these goals for the future, one of the fundamental questions we should be asking is, how are we doing? Have we begun to make this transition to a more modern, lighter, more technologically sophisticated and more green economy? Have we begun to make the transition towards a more balanced economy? If we have, what have we done well and what haven't we done well? And most important, do we have the set of institutions and the set of policies that are necessary to bring us in that direction? Now, when we look at it in this way, I think our analysis has to be a kind of firmly yes and no. There's one aspect in which I think we can say the Chinese have done extremely well and deserve a great deal of praise, and that's for the beginning of the development of a green consciousness and the beginning of a development of green industry. We know that particularly when we look at the energy sector, China has emerged as a very significant producer of new energy technologies in terms of wind power and solar power in particular. And we know that there were a lot of problems in the initial stages of the development of these industries. In particular, the industries were developed as industrial sectors and only slowly became actual producers of power. Today, though, I think we can see that policy has begun to shift in a way that means wind power has become significant in China. Wind developed 1.2% of China's electric power in 2010. Not quite as much as in the United States, but close, and a very dramatic improvement over previous years. Solar power, China is a big producer of solar panels. Not yet, however, much of a generator of power from solar panels. Last year, solar generation accounted for 0.006%. of China's electrical power, still pretty tiny by any standard. But the key point here is we see the beginnings of a process that are leading to the incorporation of green technologies into the production process. So an important start has been made, an important effort to reduce carbon emissions and to reduce pollution as well. It's important we recognize that. Now, let's take a look at the other side of it, the movement from a more unbalanced economy that's dependent upon investment, dependent upon heavy industrial development, and dependent upon export surpluses. How are we doing in this respect? Well, here we have to say that not only has overall progress not been made, but in some ways there's been regression. If we take as our benchmark the year 2005, when the 11th five-year plan was established, China's economy today, by virtually any measure, is more unbalanced. Investment is a larger share of overall economy. The export surplus, granted it was higher at an interim period in 2007 to early 2008, but it's still the export surplus is considerably larger than it was back in 2005. And in other respects as well, the economy still shows the characteristics of an extremely unbalanced economy that reflects a growth strategy that's over-reliant upon investment, over-reliant upon industry, and over-reliant upon exports. So what's going on here? We're looking at a system in which economic planners have a lot of influence, where economic planners are influenced by a vision of a lighter and more sophisticated economic and more balanced economic path, where planners have been calling for that path to be adopted, where Cheng Shui-wei says this is the correct direction for the future, and yet, in general, we would have to say that the economy is not shifting onto that superior kind of growth path, even though that's the growth path that is especially necessary for the transition as China reaches a middle-income status. So we have to ask a fundamental question, and that is, are the measures and the institutions that China is using today the appropriate ones to realize this program of economic transition? And I think to a certain extent, we have to argue that those institutions are actually not the right institutions. And let me ask a question in particular about the development of new green industries. China has made a huge commitment to new industries. And that commitment has involved a substantial investment of resources as well. It seems to me, though, that the problem is this development of new industries remains far too much under the influence of government and government-run enterprises. And this has two important results. One is that the entrepreneurial genius of the Chinese people is less effectively harnessed in the development of these industries. And the second is that government tends to reproduce the excessive expenditure of resources on investment. And so even though the industries that are now the focus of investment are better industries, they're still drawing in an enormous amount of resources that's preventing the rebalancing of the economy and the shift to a lighter, more consumption-friendly growth path. The industries that Cheng Shui has laid out are part of a program that the Chinese call the Strategic Emerging Industries. Many of these strategic emerging industries have very, very positive environmental implications. They are also, without exception, industries that are technologically extremely demanding. And they're also an extremely ambitious, wide spectrum of new industries. There are 35 of these strategic emerging industries, and they include just about every industry that you would think of when you think of the things that the United States should be developing, or Germany should be developing, or Denmark should be developing. They include not only the whole spectrum of new energy technologies, but also new materials, new biotech industries, a whole range of very, very ambitious sectors. Now, the question is, who are the firms that are going to be the cutting edge of developing these industries? And do they require large sums of money, and in particular, do they require large sums of government investment to be developed? I would suggest that an alternative institutional strategy that relies more on small firms, startup firms, research-intensive private firms would be more effective than the strategy that China is actually following today, in which the development of these firms rests primarily on government support, government incentives, and to a significant extent, direct government investment from both fiscal and banking sources. Cheng Shui, one of his many accomplishments is to be known as the father of venture capital in China. He played a predominant role in pushing for the institutions that would support new firms through new financial institutions that would channel funds to startup enterprises. We need to know how that process is working in the field of green energy, in the field of the green economy. I have the impression, and I'd love to be corrected, that these young venture capital institutions are being swamped by a flood of government money, by a flood of preferential policy, by a flood of support that tends to distort the incentive system within these newly emerging sectors. It's funny, here in the United States we have a big debate going on about the company Solyndra, which received government loan guarantees for $500 million. Whatever you think of the Solyndra process, this was a case where you clearly had an independent firm that was clearly pursuing an innovative technology that then got government support for it. I'm worried that what we see in China is less that pattern and more a pattern where existing technologies, sometimes mature, sometimes not, are ramped up rapidly, expanded quickly, because they have access to government support across a range of different activities. That kind of support has a danger because it distorts the overall global environment for these newly emerging technologies that are important for all of us. The question is, What standards will China use to evaluate their programs? When will we know that there are successes that can be expanded? When will government decide that there are failures, because there have to be failures as well, that should be terminated and cut down as far as a government priority? With 35 different sectors in the strategic emerging industries, it's a crucial question how we select among them. First of all, how we get there. But second of all, how we decide when to stop when individual initiatives don't meet with our success. In terms of the trajectory of the Chinese economy, what worries me even more is that the across-the-board priority given to a wide range of industrial sectors means inevitably that the old pattern of economic development gets recreated in the future. If we give priority to 35 different industrial sectors, that means government priority is to encourage investment into those priority sectors, and that means to a certain extent government policy is to encourage investment, period. When you look at the 12th five-year plan, there's a big difference between the first draft, which primarily stressed rebalancing, and the second draft, approved by the National People's Congress this spring, which in addition to calling for rebalancing also spends a great deal of time stressing the importance of investment in these newly emerging strategic industries. Does the plan call for an increase in investment or a moderation in the pace of investment? The truth is the plan is contradictory, and we don't know what the outcome is going to be. If we look at the outcome so far in the year 2011, China's investment rate is increasing. Consumption as a share of GDP is not increasing. The trade surplus, which definitely did drop toward the beginning of the year, is now stabilizing at a relatively high level. So we need to ask the question, what are the proper institutions, what are the proper policies designed to push China towards a better, more sustainable, more stable economic growth trajectory, and how will we know when we get there? I'll stop there.
I want to thank the speakers for two really outstanding presentations. Left me with a whole series of questions, but I'm going to have a chance to talk to them after this, so I'll get my own questions answered then. We have 40 minutes for Q&A. Let me ask you to be mindful of several things. One, feel free to direct your questions to one speaker or another or to both of them together. Secondly, we have roving microphones, so please, when you're identified, stand up and say who you are. And then thirdly, please keep in mind that questions ending a question mark. With that in mind, the floor is open. Yes, sir, back here. Yes. No, okay, go ahead, and then we'll go to this gentleman. Sir.
My question is for Mr. Chung.
I'm sorry, you are?
I'm Ben Lawson from the Department of the Army, Department of Defense. Mm-hmm. I think everybody knows that there's a lot of distrust of China in the U.S. I think less people know that China doesn't really trust the U.S. that much either, and this impacts on the economy. So for Mr. Chung, how can the U.S. build trust with China?
Oh, well, actually, I think 2 years ago in Davos, there was a panel discussion is what's the most important issue between U.S.-China relations. I said mutual trust, because without mutual trust, you can do nothing. So in this case, in my opinion, some Americans are ignorant about China. Some have some misunderstandings, and some even have some bias. So the only way to solve this problem is to promote mutual communication, to promote dialogue between, you know, different groups of these two countries. I think it's only through communication we can develop mutual understanding and mutual trust. Then we can talk about friendship and cooperation. So that's why I came here. And also I wish more and more Chinese scholars, politicians, and other people can come to the United States to talk to the American people, and also vice versa. So I think to encourage mutual communication, I think it's the most important issue.
Thank you. Okay, this gentleman, yes.
Hi, my name is Raymond, and I work at the Carnegie Endowment. I guess I just had a question for both of the speakers regarding the issue of political will or the political momentum necessary to actually implement the 12th five-year plan. It seems that there are several challenges that would face any effort to implement it, including interest groups such as local governments or construction firms, an overall emphasis on stability, which means avoiding, you know, possible shocks to the economic system, and as the leadership transition that would means that the new leadership will take several years to consolidate its rule and implement the program. So I guess my question then is, what makes the next 5 years different from the past 5 years in terms of implementation? And do you believe then that the balance of power or arguments or whatnot in the central leadership has shifted to actually implement this plan? Thank you.
Okay, after opening up, I think China already established a systematic power transition mechanism. So in this case, I think the policy will be persistent. So the transition of the leadership will have little impact on the implementation of the 12th five-year plan. Actually, I have a theory. The first generation leaders are military people because they want to seize the power. And the second generation is the scientists and engineers because they need to do the construction. And third generation should be economists and lawyers. So you can see next generation, Xi Jinping is a lawyer. Actually, he studied law in Tsinghua, and Li Keqiang studied economics in Beida. So you can see the transition is getting towards more practical and more, I think, is a we have more efficient implementation along with the existing policy.
Barry, do you have a...
Well, I have the same question, so I don't think I can answer it because it's such a good question. But, I mean, we have seen that in the case of Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao, they came to power through a very orderly succession process, and yet still it made a lot of difference who they were and how they chose to solve problems. So since the 11th five-year plan really hasn't been implemented, you know, I guess the question is whether you think the new plan and the new leadership are more likely to be implemented, and if so, why?
Well, I think actually the plan is implemented smoothly, in my opinion. Certainly, some targets maybe can be not met in the 11th five-year plan because the global financial crisis. But generally speaking, I think we are moving toward the implementation of our five-year plan. And I think in the 12th five-year plan, we can also implement smoothly. Certainly, there you raise a very important question: is changing the people's ideology. This is very important, from GDP worship to really pay attention to sustainable development. So this takes some time, but you can see we are moving towards that direction, because in China's system, if the Central Committee of the CPC made the resolution, everyone have to follow it. Certainly there are some resistance and inertia, but general direction, the ball is rolling toward that direction. No doubt for that.
Let's see, back there.
Thank you. Dong Guiyu with the China Press. My question is for Mr. Chen. More and more people are getting concerns about the local debt problem in China right now. And some Western economists even predicted the next subprimary crisis will be happening in China. What do you think about this issue? And secondly, the Chinese President Hu Jintao is visiting Europe right now. And Do you think China should put some money into the fund to rescue the Europe debt crisis? And because somebody said it's a very good opportunity for China to diversify its foreign exchange reserve. What do you think about that? Thank you.
I was just at a meeting in Europe the last few days, and I will say every European raised exactly the same question.
As I said in Dalian in the summer Davos, China's GDP is only 8% of the world. We cannot bail the Americans out. We can also neither American out nor the Europeans out. But certainly we would like to help because if the Eurozone collapse, it will be a disaster not only for the European countries but for the countries all over the world. But I don't think we can have we can play a very important role in bail the Europeans out. Because although we have $3 trillion reserve, $1.4 trillion is in the United States. Can we cash the American bond to buy the European bond? I don't think so. Right.
You can.
And the local debt problem? The local debt.
Yes, your first question. Actually, that because in the 2009 we need to stimulate our economy, so the local government got a lot of debt. That's the reason. Actually, in the fourth quarter of 2009, I said the subprime in the United States is to give the money to the people who don't have the capability to pay back. And in the subprime with Chinese characteristics is banks give the loan to the local government, which doesn't have the opportunity, doesn't have the capacity to pay back. According to our audit agency, by the end of June this year, the total debt is 10.7 trillion renminbi. And one third of them, of the local government, don't have the capability to pay back. So this is a big problem. So, and we are now trying to solve this problem. But I don't think it will have the same impact as the subprime to the United States, because one is our central government have the strong capability to bail them out. But in my opinion, we should not encourage the default of the local governments. So the central government only can help them in those projects related to people's living and to education or social security. So in this case, I think central government will help to solve this problem.
Barry, do you want to weigh in on that? No. Okay, fine. Thank you. Yes, here.
Energy.
I'm Mai Yugu from University of Oxford, currently a guest researcher at John Thornton China Center in Brookings. My question follows up to Professor Norton's question that how do we achieve the transformation in economy in terms of institution? We know that currently the heavy industries are still lack of the incentive to reduce coal consumptions. So in your opinion, apart from technologies, what are the main institutional challenges to make those stakeholders in the highly polluted industry to take action to reduce the carbon emission?
Okay, actually, you know, China is in the middle stage of industrialization. So heavy and chemical industry still have a very important position. Now China is the largest steel producer in the world. This is not surprising because if you look up history, UK, then US, then former Soviet Union, then Japan, now China. Maybe 20 years later, India will be the largest. But China is now in this stage. So what I'm saying is we need to raise the energy efficiency and reduce CO2 emission in those heavy and chemical industries. Actually, the Chinese government enforced a very very rigorous requirement for those state-owned enterprises. They have the target to reduce their CO2 emission. If they cannot meet the target, the top management will be punished. So this is a very rigorous. So on the other hand, I disagree with you. Is actually in our solar energy industry, the private sector plays a more important role. The top three in China, one is Changzhou, the other in Wuxi, the third in Baoding, are all private sectors. Two of them are the party member of my party, the China Democratic, National Democratic Construction Association. So I know they are really, the solar energy at this time being, the giants are the private sectors, just for your information.
Yeah, that's great. And so why not expand that model to the other strategic and non-strategic industries? I mean, it seems to me steel is a good example where, yeah, we've done a pretty good job of imposing tougher energy requirements on the state firms. But if you're talking about a real fundamental restructuring of this huge industry, it hasn't happened. And the reason it hasn't happened, in my opinion, is because there are just too many limitations on what private firms can do, and of course, no foreign firms, and that prevents a really fundamental qualitative improvement in the efficiency and energy efficiency of this sector. So I think we're in the same camp here, but how we evaluate the steps taken might be a little different.
Charles Benoit, General Electric. For a question for both of you. Could you talk about the competition between state-owned enterprises, which report to the central government, and ones that are controlled by municipalities, or and specifically in the renewables sector? China's leading wind turbine manufacturer, Sinovel, is state-owned but by municipality, and China Guodian and its renewable subsidiary, Longwang, is now getting into manufacturing as well. And so I'd love to hear about how you see the central SOEs competing against sub-central SOEs, and also perhaps their relationship with NRDC or with the central government. Do they are central favored over, or just how they would interact differently with the central government?
So this is competition within the state sector between centrally owned state firms and locally owned state firms.
Right, and I think in renewables is this, and especially wind turbines would be.
You mean between the SOE and the private sectors?
No, between the state-owned enterprises, basically the SASAC enterprises and local state-owned enterprises.
Oh.
What kind of different treatment do they have, and how do they deal with each other?
Well, we have a hierarchy. As you know, we have a hierarchical structure in this. Some big SOEs belong to the state, and some the relatively small is belong to the provincial governments. So I think, generally speaking, their behavior, I think, mainly depend of the market, you know, orientation, because they are making their profit. But in some place, they have to take the advices or orders from the government. So I don't think they have a severe confrontation. But in some cases, this reflect the contradiction between the central government and the local government, because this is a dilemma between centralization and the decentralization. So in some cases, there are some contradiction. But generally speaking, I don't think it's a big problem. The big problem is between the state-owned sector, the public sector, and the private sector. I think this is a major problem in China now.
Major problem in the sense of what?
Because they are not equal in this at this time being. You know, the state-owned sector get more privileges in terms of investment, bank loans, and other policy supports.
Thank you. If I could jump in with just one question of my own that I'm dying to ask, which is you commented that the foreign exchange reserves of China have become a big burden because they exceed $3 trillion U.S. dollars. And in reality, the appropriate level for China would be more like $1.2 trillion U.S. dollars, right?
Yes.
And my question is, how do you go from $3 trillion to $1.2
trillion? So actually, as the Premier Wen said, we would like to convert our debt into investment in the United States, right? So then we can...
$2 trillion of investment. Good. Okay. yes, Rebecca. Yeah.
Hi, Damian Ma from DeRazor Group. I have a fairly simple question. So if you had to give two grades on the 12-5-year plan, one on the aspirational aspects of it and one on the capacity to actually realize those aspirations, which two grades would you give to those two characteristics for the both of you?
What's your question? I didn't get it.
Two grades. So one on the aspirations and then the targets in the 12-5-year plan, which I suspect you guys would probably give both give it an A, but on the second, what grade would you give on the actual capacity and the ability to execute that plan? What grade would you give on that characteristic?
You mean do we have the capability to implement the plan?
Yeah, right. Basically that's the question.
What grade would you give it? Would you give it an A, a B, a C, a D, or
You mean the 11th five-year plan?
No, this plan.
12. This plan?
Yes.
This plan is now in the process of implementing, so how can I get the grade after?
Hypothetically, what do you think?
general speaking, it's very difficult to predict the future, you know. So I cannot give you an exact grade. I think we would like to achieve an A, but if we can achieve a B, it's also not bad.
The real answer is he wants to wait until he can read the final exam and then grade it. Barry, do you have a comment?
Since I'm a practicing college professor, I'll boldly give some grades. I think the 11th five-year plan gets an A for objectives, and the 12th five-year plan maybe a B+. In other words, it's actually less clear. It has a less compelling vision. You can see more of the workings of the political compromise process in terms of what gets into the plan. Neither of them have any implementation mechanisms in them, so it's pretty hard to grade the implementation mechanism. But if you, the 11th five-year plan, you could more arguably say, well, it kind of got blown off course by the global financial crisis and bad exchange rate policy. Those two things together, you know, knocked it off course. The 12th five-year plan, I don't know that it has a course. I don't see that there are implementation mechanisms yet. And most of the implementing documents haven't come out yet. They're behind schedule. They haven't come out. So I think it shows there are problems with that. So that's a C.
Okay. Yes, sir, back here.
Scott Ottoman of Inside U.S. China Trade. For Mr. Chung, what does the new five-year plan say about China's commitment to implementing intellectual property protections, and how does that play in a lot of the focus of the United States government in the upcoming meetings of the JCCT, the Joint Commission on Commerce and Trade, is going to be on getting implementation of commitments to protect intellectual property, buy more software from the government, by the government of private firms that's legal, et cetera. And I'm wondering that and indigenous innovation not forcing the transfer of technology through intellectual property requirements, is that something that the government has thought through in trying to move forward in this five-year
yes.
plan?
Yes. This is a big issue, IPR protection, right? This is a big issue. Actually, in the year 2005, I talked to the Deputy Secretary of Justice, Department of Justice in the United States. I said, first, is we spend less than 20 years to build up our IPR protecting system. We now have our trademark law, copyright law, and patent law. Second is, if you look about the development degree, we are only, that time, only equivalent to the United States in the 1930s. But now we are in the 21st century. So we cannot just copy your Sherman Act to implement in the 21st century. So we have to make some modifications from your... We learn from you, but we have to make some modifications. And the third is, you need to see the whole picture of China. We are making efforts to improve our IPR protection. I myself, at that time, led a task force to supervise the implementation of patent law, and we made some proposals to revise our patent law. Fourth is, we cannot deny there are some individual cases. So if you have some individual case, please just write to me. Not now, but that time. I'm now retired, so don't write to me. At that time, please write to me. We will treat this. So actually, I think the IPR protection is improving, but certainly I cannot promise there will be no individual cases. But if there is an individual case, you will take some measures or sue the or take them to the court. I think there are some examples. Some foreign companies sued the Chinese companies and they won. So I think you can do this.
Okay. Yes, back there. This young lady, yes.
Hi, my name is Haya Zhang from International Fund for China's Environment. We're an NGO headquartered in D.C. and 6 different offices in China. And my question for Mr. Chen is, where do you see the roles of NGOs, nonprofit, non-government organizations in China for the new 5-year plan? Are we even in the picture? Where are some opportunities and some challenges that we might have?
Well, I think NGO will play a more and more important role in China. Actually, now, because along with the development of China, along with the increase of people's income, they want to express, you know, their more of their opinions, and also because the development of a micro blog, Weibo, you know, like the Twitter in the United States, and Renrenwang, like the Facebook in the United States, you know, the information flow is getting faster and faster, and also the transparency is increasing. So in this case, the NGOs will play more and more important role. And now we are talking about the third party, right? Third party, that means besides government and enterprises, we have to have the third party force, you know, to make the society more healthy. But if you look about the United States occupying Wall Street, also reflect some kind of these kind of problems. Just do your work, and I believe you will have a bright future. Okay.
Right here, this gentleman.
Thank you. Don Clark, George Washington University Law School. My question's for Mr. Chung. You said that you felt trade disputes should not be politicized, right? And my question is, why not? I think Professor Naughton, in his remarks, showed very clearly that China's current trade relationship with the rest of the world is really a necessary outcome of a lot of political decisions that have been made. For example, the growth strategy. That's a political decision to have over-reliance on investment, industry, and an export surplus. The policy of the PBOC, People's Bank of China, to buy U.S. dollars at a particular rate, that's a political decision. So why is it not legitimate to talk politics when talking about trade?
Maybe we have different definition for politicization. In my opinion, we need to take a more objective attitude towards the trade imbalance issue. Don't take China as a scapegoat. You know, that's my point. Just as I said in my example. So certainly non-economic activities is not related to the policy. That's right. If you say this, I agree with you. But don't just because of political reasons to attack the others, you know, using a unobjective language. That's my point. I don't know if you agree or not.
Chia Chen, freelance correspondence, persistent manner. Mr. Zhen, thank you for your comment. My question primary is for you, but if Dr. Norton want to join, if you wish. First is this, China quite success in anti-poverty plan. And should China use have lots of money, should use to make this anti-poverty plan more deep and more broad. And in this case, maybe also could make a trade not quite rely on export. And second is this, as to the economic growth, should also add the real value in addition to the percentage. And as a domestic product, it's also that instead of say how much of a nation, in terms of a nation, also add in terms of individual. Thank you.
He put the question to both of us. I will let you go first.
Why don't you go ahead?
I'm not sure I understood the question. Okay. So when the first question is anti-poverty. Yes, China get quite a big progress, but still on a relatively low level. If you take the definition of poor people, you can see in the United States, I think it's around 10,000. I mean, poor people, individual comes will be less than $11,139, as I remember, maybe not correct. And according to the World Bank, it's $456 per year. And in China, we are much lower than this. So that means if you use the criterion of the World Bank, we are still lower than this. So we have more poor people. So that means we still have a long way to go, objectively, right? So in this case, we still have to promote the anti-poverty program in China. Actually, we are now not only by the government, but also by some third party for us to help the poor people. So I put forward a conception is a third distribution. First distribution is the salary by the market. Second distribution is by the government, by the transfer payment. And the third distribution is the rich people voluntarily to help the poor people. So we are promoting the charity business in China as a complementary, as a supplementary measure to anti-poverty. So,
Thank you. What I think we'll do, we're running short on time. Let me collect three questions, and then I'll give each of you an opportunity to respond to what you wish to or make any other summary comments you wish to make, okay? This will be the first, this young lady here. Either of you.
Hi, my name is Ariel. I work for a Japanese trade company called Mitsui. And I have a question regarding your improvement of Chinese education system. As we know that there's a lot of Chinese students in China and limited resources, so they have a limited opportunity to pursue what they want to do and have only a stringent subject they can learn. And there's also Gaokao system, the entrance exam system that determine people's future so that kind of hinder innovation or innovative spirit in China. So I'm wondering, for the new 5 years plan, what's the policies, or do you see a drastic change of the entire education selection system, such as Gaokao, or you're trying to encourage more investment from Western educational system in China, or how to keep Chinese talent to stay at home, not to go overseas for undergrad or postgraduate.
Thank you. Yes, sir, back here. Actually, I was pointing right behind you.
So. Do you want me to answer it?
No, let's collect three questions, then you can respond as you wish.
Okay.
Okay, just because we only have a couple of minutes left.
Education.
Hi, I'm Aaron Malas from McLarty Associates. I was wondering if each of you could speak perhaps briefly to how this five-year plan might impact China's trade and economic relationships with other regions of the world, not just the U.S. In particular, I'd be curious to hear about Latin America, where a number of countries, including Brazil, have started to take some measures of their own to try to address their trade imbalances, and whether this is being taken into account at all by the Chinese government, and whether it might be in this plan or perhaps a future one.
Thank you. Anyone? Yes, back there.
Thanks. Stella Dawson at Reuters. 10 years after China's accession to the WTO, a number of U.S. corporations complain that the bargain that they anticipated of access to the Chinese market has not been lived up to, in particular with regard to state-owned enterprises and intellectual property rights and indigenous innovation.
Could you speak a little louder?
Oh, sorry. So 10 years after accession to the WTO, do you see the relationship becoming more adversarial between the U.S. and China? And how do you respond to those charges from the U.S. corporations?
This is on market access? And,
yeah, and I would like both persons' comments. Yeah.
The market entry, right?
Yeah, basically the expectations in terms of market entry treatment in China. From the WTO 10 years later. How do you see this? Barry, do you want to begin?
you go first.
And feel free to respond specifically to any of the last three questions raised or other issues that you think you want to.
Yeah. Well, I guess I just like to contribute to the depoliticization trend by saying that, I'd like to see a lot of these issues depoliticized by getting the discussion within China more firmly focused on a basis of what's good for the long-run development of China in the context of these five-year plans and in the context of a turning point in the Chinese economy, where we look at Chinese society and it's exploding with diversity and creativity and, people who've been released from decades of poverty and have a whole new set of demands on the economic system. Now, in that context, is the education system responding quickly enough? It's doing pretty well, but probably needs a little more. Definitely, we could see further educational reforms of this type. WTO bargain. Well, let's put that in the context of the Chinese domestic bargain. I mean, I think there was explosive progress in economic reforms through the 1990s that slowed down. And I think it's a disadvantage for multinational corporations, yes. But frankly, I'm more worried about the fact that it's a disadvantage for the healthy development of the Chinese economy, given this explosion in creativity and diversity. I don't think China has violated its WTO commitments, but there hasn't been as much positive progress as we had hoped for, and as I think many people in China had hoped for as well. So, I don't know, that's side.
Okay. And for the education I just mentioned, we need to reform our education system. And actually, we formulated a mid- and a long-term education plan, as we published, I think, early this year. But certainly to change the Gaokao system is a very bit difficult issue. So because China has so huge a population, so how do you select the students to the universities? I don't think it's an easy job. But what I'm saying is we need to pay more attention to encourage innovative spirit in our universities, rather than to foster the straight A students. That's my point. And for the WTO, I think we have a basic attitude is we oppose the trade protectionism. But the problem is we still need to improve our environment, our investment environment. So in this case, I think both, even in the United States, it also needs to improve your investment environment. So I think at this time being, China, although we are not so satisfactory to the foreign investors, some foreign investors not so satisfactory, but generally speaking, we are making a lot of progress. Just like the chairman of Coca-Cola mentioned, you know, the investment environment in China is improving, maybe better than in the United States.
Thank you very much. Let me say this discussion has raised a lot of fundamental issues about how China has done in recent years and then what are the prospects. We will be having another program this Thursday afternoon. I assume all of you have received notice of it since you're on our mailing list, that will consider the evolution of the Chinese economy since 2002 in various sectors and then what the prospects are for the future. So that, in a way, is a continuation of the issues raised here. In fact, Professor Naughton will be one of the speakers, as will Nick Lardy, sitting in the front row here. So it'll be a distinguished group, and if you haven't signed up for that, please don't hesitate to do so. I want to thank again the Asia Foundation for bringing Cheng Siwei to the United States on the Cheng Tian Lin Fellowship. As always, I want to thank the Thornton Center staff for the yeoman work they always do in putting on these programs, and especially want to thank our two speakers for their remarkably candid and informative and helpful set of comments today. Please join me in thanking them.